You're watching the Family Learning Channel. And now, angry ticks fire out of my nipples.
Hello, welcome to Words and Pictures, the animation and cartoonist show on KBOO Radio. I'm SW Conser.
And I'm Bill Dodge.
And we're talking today with animator Don Hertzfeld, award-winning filmmaker and one of the originators of the Turing Festival, the animation show. Welcome to Words and Pictures, Don.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about this trilogy you're working on. It started with the movie Everything Will Be Okay, and it's this exploration of a character as he descends into some sort of madness brought on by illness, and it's been called your most philosophical and existential work. You know, that's an interesting take because a lot of people think of you as a comedic filmmaker.
Yeah, I think to somebody on the outside, it looks like there's been a shift. But the ideas for all of these films actually date back to about 1999. And I think just back then, I wasn't clever enough to get these kinds of stories on the screen yet. But Everything Will Be Okay and Proud, there's comedy in there. You know, it's still kind of coming from the same voice, but the films would be pretty bitter films to swallow without a little lightness in there.
It's funny you mentioned bitter films because the name of your production company is Bitter Films.
There you go.
So your new film, I Am So Proud of You, is the middle section of a trilogy that starts with Everything Will Be Okay, and a third yet-to-be-filmed ending part of the trilogy is coming up in the future. What can you tell us about the star of the short film trilogy, Bill?
There's something very wrong with him. The story came out of a comic strip I did for my website many years ago. It was a very strange strip. There was never a punchline, and they weren't particularly funny. It was just, today Bill went to the grocery store, and then the next few panels were things he observed in the grocery store. They were very mysterious, I guess is what I should say. They were more surreal than what you'd expect in a standard strip. I didn't really know what it all meant, but I just knew I wanted to do more with it. And that's where the idea of something being wrong with him is, and you know, he's very ill. There's something a little off. There's one key piece that I got from a short story I read maybe 10 years ago. It was a Holocaust short story about a group of people who were being marched out of their village by Nazis, and they were being marched across a bridge where they were going to be shot. And the character in the story, he had lived in this village his entire life, and it was just like any other day, but as he's being marched across this bridge, he notices that the water looks different that day, and he notices that there's details in the cobblestones, and there's details in his friends' faces that he's never noticed before, and it's almost beautiful, but it's very surreal, because it is just like any other day, only clearly it's not, and I wanted to inject some of that into Bill's story. You know, here's somebody who he may have been diagnosed with something, and he may only have 3 months to live, or maybe that's just what he's been told, and how regular day-to-day life, things on television, things in the supermarket, weird things people say on the street, all of a sudden has that surreal element to it, because all of a sudden the meaning of everything you see has changed, and you're seeing the world through these different goggles. And that's where Everything Will Be Okay starts up, and I Am So Proud of You, as most second chapters are, you know, we're able to get deeper and darker and a little more further down the rabbit hole.
And do you remember the name of that short story by any chance?
I don't, I'm sorry. I knew that was going to be the follow-up, yeah. But I can't remember.
Well, the Ottawa International Animation Festival just ended up in Canada, and the director of the festival, Chris Robinson, said that your film, I Am So Proud of You, affected him so deeply that he had to just go and be alone for a while afterwards.
I like that. Yeah, that was fantastic to hear that. I've only seen the movie with an audience once, and I didn't even get to see how it ended with them. I was backstage. So it's still very new to me. It's still very new to see it with people and to hear from them. And that's really at the end of the day why I'm touring. When you show your movie on television and put it on DVD, of course you're going to get many, many, many more viewers. But you can't see it happen. You can't watch it all unfold for them unless you go start visiting people's living rooms. And touring with it and being in the theater and having that energy and seeing how it communicates and the give and take with the audience, I mean, all of that, I think that's why most of us wanted to become filmmakers in the first place. You know, hearing the laughter, hearing where it works and where it doesn't, and that is fuel. You know, that is very, very important to me, and so that's what I'm looking forward to. It's a 16-city tour, and I'm sure in every city it's going to get a different reaction, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
You talk about yourself as a traditionalist when it comes to filmmaking, and when you got your start at 18, it was the mid-90s. Traditional camera stand animation was already going out of style, and a lot of the digital applications such as Flash and Maya and Lightwave were all the rage. But your tool of choice is still an old Richardson camera stand, and your latest film has several things going on at one time on the screen, but instead of arranging things digitally, you do old-school techniques like front light, backlight, and multiple passes. And what that means is you shoot one bit of artwork, you backwind the film in this camera, and you shoot another bit of artwork, and you just have to line it up perfectly with all of the previous stuff. This is incredibly time-consuming, but you believe in all of these old tools, paper, pencil, film, and light.
Absolutely, and I think there's a big misconception with all the digital tools and the CGI stuff that it's easier and that there's a make art button on a computer. I think the public kind of, because it's very difficult to understand how computers work, I think they just assume that computer animators have these magic wands and that it all just comes very easily to them. I think if I was a computer animator, I'd be very annoyed by this. But computers do some things better. Cameras do other things better. I don't think there needs to be this versus mentality, and that's kind of the sad truth of it. When I was getting started, it was all 16 millimeter still at my school, and when I bought that big 35 millimeter camera, you could probably have driven down the street in Burbank and picked up one on the curb. Everyone was just dumping these things in favor of computers, and I think it's sad that we've got over 100 years of film technology here, yet the old stuff keeps getting thrown out. You know, that we should be playing with all of these tools. You know, we've got this giant toy box of film history to play with, and yet it seems more likely today any film artist is going to be working from the same limited palette of the same three programs. In animation especially, I think that's starting to make everyone's work look the same. But getting back to the camera, my last three films would have been visually impossible without this camera. The compositing, it's tricky, it's difficult, but it's not as time-consuming as you'd think. It just takes a little more preparation, but the beauty of it is I'm able to rig these shots up on the spot with my hands. I've got the artwork, I've got the lighting. Between the artwork, I can hang sheets of plastic diffusion, I can angle the lights, and it's all right there. You know, I'm seeing it with my hands, with the paint, with whatever I'm working with, right through the lens, and you get visuals that you may never have come up with in the computer. My trouble with working with a computer is, personally, it's a lot less fun.
The accidents aren't as interesting, for one thing.
Yeah, and you just get those happy accidents where the light hits the camera lens in a way you've never expected. But the trouble with the computer is everything on the screen has to be artificially placed there. And that is more tedious to me than the way I work. I always go back to this live-action example. If you look at Akira Kurosawa's movie, Ran, there's a monstrous scene of two giant armies racing at each other, kind of Braveheart style, and it's a distant shot, and the shadows of fast-moving clouds are cast over each of these armies, and it's as if the gods are controlling this war on this vast explain. And as amazing as Akira Kurosawa was, I don't think, you know, he could control the heavens that day. It's more likely they reached the location and, oh my God, look at this amazing vista we've got. Let's get down there and shoot it. And it's the sort of spontaneity and the happy accidents that I get out of working like this, you know.
I was going to say, don't sell Akira Kurosawa short.
Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe he could control the clouds that day.
Cue the clouds.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, that's the example I keep going back to, where, you know, it's that level of injecting the uncertainty into your film. I really like Stan Brakhage. I really like the experimental stuff, and I am so proud of you, and everything will be okay. Some of the scenes are in that sense, you know, where you are hitting the lens with lights and light leaks and paint and exposures, and you're not really quite sure how it's going to come out when you get back to the lab, and that's the exciting part. You know, you get these images that you may never have otherwise imagined.
So you must be a big fan of films on the big screen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's getting strange out there. You know, it's the digital media, it's coming faster than a lot of people can deal with it. And I think you're kidding yourself if you think you can watch a movie on your phone. You know, you shoot on film, it belongs in a theater. That's its native format. Just like you shouldn't really blow up a cartoon made for the internet to an IMAX screen, because it's never going to fit right. And the richness and the clarity of the image on the big screen, you know, when you're projecting film, or even projecting a nice digital copy, you can't really replace that. I'm of the traditionalist opinion that movies really demand your complete attention, dark room, some friends, if you have them. And I think the internet is great, but it's primarily great for video clips of your cat falling off the roof.
Yeah.
I think the problem I have with it is it reduces your work to a novelty, you know, because when I'm looking at stuff online, most of the time I'm checking my email, I've got two other pages open, and, you know, you've got the film playing in a corner maybe, you know, it's not really quite the same experience. I think these works really demand and deserve your full attention.
Your average animation director will have a stable of people who are taking care of everything from the in-betweens, these are the drawings in between the main poses, to the sound edit, the composition of the music, the editing. But you're a one-man band, so when you take on a movie project, it's pretty much just you. And since you yourself admit that you're not much of an artist, that your characters are by and large stick figures, this is what makes everything so effective. You have this this dead-on sense of pacing in your movies. You know how to put an audience on edge. You do this sound. This is probably the closest thing to David Lynch. You do sound that often takes the place of action.
Oh, absolutely. It's easily half of the experience. I mean, and a lot of people, they finish their picture and they hand off the soundtrack. They think they're finished, and it's like, oh, well, the animation's done. And I mean, that's the most fun part of it. I love sound. I think if I wasn't an animator or doing whatever it is I'm doing, I'd want to be a sound guy. It's amazing, especially with animation, because, you know, you don't have any recorded dialogue. You don't have any location sound. You're starting from scratch, and every scene you're building from absolute scratch. And it's amazing how powerful that is. It's amazing how you can structure a scene a completely different way with the right sound.
Yeah, you had one particular part of Rejected where you have these characters being badly dubbed, like an old Hong Kong kung fu film.
Yeah, it was. I would call that film our Sergeant Pepper phase. We just threw everything against the wall, because you really enter the sound stage with a blank slate. You've got the silent cartoon with these mouths moving, because the structure of the movie, it's just these screens of text explaining the ads. You could put anything between those and try and make it funny. We were improvising lines. At one point, we realized that they were funny, or if they were just played backwards and slowed down 20%. I mean, that was pretty wild in there. And it's important, I think, to keep that spirit of spontaneity in animation as much as you can, because the production process of it is you're sitting at a desk sweating away in the most mundane possible way to make a movie one frame at a time. And to inject any kind of energy and improvisation and spontaneity in that process is so huge. I mean, you've got to keep yourself fresh before you drive yourself into the desk.
Do you have an ideal music that you think would meld with your work?
It's almost exclusively been that classical music and opera. I almost used an Arcade Fire song for a film, but I'm really glad in hindsight that I didn't. I think the danger there is, unless they're writing something just for you, you get into that topical area that I'm a little afraid of, because there's a danger of getting a pop song or an artist that will date your film, and in 20 years it won't really fit as well. I've tried to avoid that as much as I can, and classical music too, it really fits well with what I'm doing, and to me it's the most beautiful music ever written, and it's also practical. It's very easy to license. All these composers are dead, let's be honest. And it's also something that can inspire the visuals. I've only worked with a composer once, and I didn't like it. It's difficult for me to picture how the movie is going to come together without having the music yet. To hand a finished picture off to a composer, that is such a gigantic amount of trust that I'm not quite ready for. Like, it's so crucial. The music is over 50% of the experience to me when I'm working on these things, that it's got to come in from the ground floor. Like, I've got to find that perfect piece, and then the scene starts to make sense, and I can sculpt everything around it.
Dance! Everybody dance!
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures with myself, Bill Dodge, and my co-host, S.W. Concer. Today's guest is animator Don Hertzfeldt. Don, can you tell us a little bit more about some things that stand out for you in animation history, maybe pre-World War II?
Wow. Well, I think throughout animation history, the most important thing is the short film. Obviously, animation started in shorts, but everything interesting, experimental, innovative, exciting has always started in short films. I think that's still true today. I mean, you can go from Disney to Chuck Jones to the UPA guys, you know, all the way through Pixar, Aardman, Bill Plimpton, you know, everyone, Tim Burton, David Lynch, even these live-action directors starting in animated shorts. And right there is one of the main reasons we started the animation show. I mean, if you look at the studios, not that interesting. If you look at the internet and what's playing in programs like the animation show and film festivals in Ottawa, there are some wild and exciting things going on, especially with all the digital media. I mean, it's just, there's no comparison to what the studios are doing. I think the trouble is, you get to the studio level, animation is so expensive to produce. 9 times out of 10, you've got these films written by committees, and let's face it, they're designed to sell toys. And the short form is the only medium of film that you could realistically make a movie by yourself. You can't really do that with live action or documentaries. And I think it's the purest form of filmmaking. You know, you're making it one frame at a time. You can put anything on the screen that you can imagine. You're not limited by anything. And in the short form, that's where artists have always been free. When I was a little kid, I kept bugging my parents for a video camera. I always wanted to make movies, but even back then I wanted to be Stanley Kubrick. I wanted to get into live action. By the time I went to film school, though, you really realize, I mean, back then it was all 16mm, which is pretty expensive film stock to afford, and all the live-action kids were spending up to $30,000 of their rich uncle's money, and I just had no connections. I had no way of being able to afford live-action, but if you stick with cartoons, you know, you can work all by yourself, and you're only paying for one roll of film, because that's the shooting ratio for cartoons, so it was kind of a marriage of convenience that just kind of took off. I was lucky enough to do 4 films in 4 years, and they all found distributors, and it was just a great great situation. Like, there was a 16mm animation camera on the campus that nobody else was using, and I was just like, could I actually animate my films and get credit for that? And they're like, yeah, yeah, and I just couldn't believe that that counted, you know? Like, to me, I'd been animating in high school and on videotape, and to me, that was just fun, and I felt like I was getting away with something, and it was just a dream come true. They gave me the keys to the building, and in 4 years, I had no oversight. I was able to just kind of do what I want to in there, so... It was UC Santa Barbara, by the way, which I just feel like luckiest college choice I could have made. And it's primarily a school for film history and film theory and analysis and really heady stuff, which I enjoy.
So did they sit you in front of Potemkin and explain everything about that?
Oh, yeah, and all the Russian terms for the sujet, the fabula, all the formalist theories. Oh my God, yeah. And but the beauty of it was, because the focus was on that stuff, the kids weren't really clawing each other's eyes out to get to the cameras. You know, there wasn't a lot of emphasis on production, so there wasn't a lot of craziness over it. And a lot of these production schools, you're lucky to touch a camera by your third year, but I was, you know, off and running my first year.
Now, you mentioned Kubrick as an influence. Yeah, what about Kubrick?
I remember seeing 2001 very young, and my dad had the record of the Richard Strauss theme there, and it struck me as, I couldn't believe that people made this movie. I had no idea how it was made. I had no idea how the music could be so big and powerful, and the images, and that just knocked me out. I try and watch it every year still. And then, you know, I quickly discovered the rest of his stuff.
There is humor in 2001, too. You probably remember the anti-gravity toilet.
Yeah, you know, and there's humor in a lot of Kubrick. I mean, I think Full Metal Jacket, the first half is hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think in Clockwork Orange, I mean, there's a darkness to it, but it's the sort of intelligent stuff that I'm really attracted to. You know, it's comedy, but it's so dark and it's so different that you're actually thinking about why you're laughing about it. You're taken aback a little bit. I like these projects where you see one or two frames, you see a scene, and the voice of the artist is already there. You know, the pictures are telling you a story before the narrative even kicks in. You see the film and you, oh yeah, that's David Lynch. It's unmistakable. It's sort of like, if you look at it in animation terms, it's like, well, that's a Bill Plimpton drawing. Well, that's a Mike Judge drawing.
Since you mentioned your friend Bill Plimpton, who thinks that you are funnier than him, which is a great kudos considering, you know, his body of work.
Yeah, I think what you can say about Bill is, you know, there's a famous saying about the Velvet Underground, and their influence in the 60s was that, you know, they didn't sell a million albums, but everyone who bought one of the Velvet Underground's albums went out and started their own band. And I think Bill Plimpton, you know, he's never sold, you know, a million copies of his work, but I can't think of anyone else around that time who launched more ships, who, you know, they saw Bill Plimpton's work and were just, I can do this too, you know, this something about his stuff just really lights fires under artists, and it's just so encouraging to see someone like, wow, he, you know, it's this interesting sketchy style, he doesn't like to draw backgrounds either. And he's the only other guy I know of in the United States who's doing this sort of thing without having to have a second job. There's just no market for it in this country.
So Bill Plimpton talks about Plimpton's dogma. Keep it under $10,000, keep it about 5 minutes or shorter, and make it funny. Would you agree with that?
You know, I've heard Bill say that a lot, and I've debated him a lot. I obviously don't agree with that because I've broken that rule. The last three films are all much longer than 5 minutes, and they're not strictly comedies, and I've spent over $10,000. I think it's great advice for students. It's very realistic. I mean, you do have much, much better chances of getting programmed in film festivals, let's face it, if it's funny and it's short. That's absolutely true. On the other hand, you have to make sure that you're making films on your own terms. If your film doesn't happen to be funny in under 5 minutes, you can't really fake it. You know, it's still got to be an honest work, and to that end, it needs to take its own shape. So it's very practical advice, but if that's not where you're going, I wouldn't sweat it too much, because at the end of the day, you can't make films for what you think people want to see. I mean, I've always thought, you know, if you want to make a movie based on what you think other people want to see, you'd be better off giving them the camera, because you're never going to please everybody. You've just got to not second-guess yourself. I think that's the biggest pitfall a lot of students and a lot of beginning writers run into. It's the, is this good enough question, you know, the paranoia of, will I be judged, will people hate this? And you've got to throw all of that out, or you'll just be crippled every step of the way.
Well, we are a non-commercial radio station. You know that the Family Learning Channel and Johnson & Mill are not one of our sponsors. And I think you were saying that you don't really want to do commercials, although there's some commercials that seem to be imitating you.
Oh, there's many. Yeah.
Pop-Tarts is one big example. Apparently, the Kellogg Corp just tried to make their Pop-Tarts commercial look as much like a Don Hertzfeldt film as humanly possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even worth bringing them their name into it. They don't deserve it, but...
We'll say a big company, then.
Say that. Yeah. Big breakfast food company.
You know, it's happened a lot, and my main annoyance with it is people thinking I'm responsible.
So you have been around long enough that you're kind of being branded by other people, in a sense. They say, let's do it like that Hertzfeldt guy. You know, instead of calling him up, we'll just imitate him. Yeah, okay. Oh, that's popular. Let's grab it.
It's pretty strange. Yeah, it's pretty strange to see happen. And the most, I got to say that I was really struck by an email I got from a kid at an animation school who wrote in to say that his professor was discussing my work in his class, and he made a point of bringing up what he thought was this TV commercial I did, and he was using that as the primary example of why I was successful. And it struck me as just really depressing that no matter how many films I make independently, no matter what they do, no matter where they go, to most people teaching animation and to most people in the industry, you're only really successful if you're financially successful, if you're selling out to a corporation. It's like, well, he's made these movies, but now he's really made it because he got this gig doing tampon ads. That to me is just, it's sad. You know, it's weird and bizarre that, you know, that's the bar they're setting, and they're teaching that. To me, it's like if you're looking at a music conservatory and they're teaching all the young composers, you know, they're guiding them to just write ad jingles.
Yeah.
You know, they're not really encouraged to write their own thing, to be like Bill Plimpton, to explore their voice. It's all money, you know, it's all advertising, and I guess, you know, it's very realistic in, you know, because this market for short films in the country is, well, there isn't one, and it is very difficult, but no, I've never done a commercial, and I've always said I never will.
In that case, let's give listeners an idea of some of the imaginary products and rejected. Johnson & Mills Bean Lard Mulch, now with vitamin C, and J&M's Kelp Dip.
It's like the word kelp dip.
It just sounds funny, doesn't it?
I think when I was living in Eugene, they actually had kelp dip at some of the co-ops.
Wow.
No, I'm making that up.
I wouldn't put it past Oregon.
Yeah, it's not like you haven't been called up by commercial agencies. United Airlines and Singular have wanted you to do commercials for them, and I think your response was that commercials are lies and you weren't interested.
I guess that's the source of it. I think that's a famous misquote, but I wouldn't, I guess, disagree with that. It's hard to explain. It's a tremendous amount of work to make one of these films, as you can imagine. I'm primarily working alone, and something like I Am So Proud of You, which is 22 minutes, which is the longest thing I've ever done, it took upwards of 2 years, and that was actually, for that length of time, that was good production progress. But I'm writing, I'm animating, as soon as I'm done animating, I'm shooting, still writing, that goes into the editing, while I'm still shooting and writing, as soon as I'm done editing, right into sound, still writing, and then the soundtrack's done, and it goes straight into post-production. I mean, there's never a break. It's just 7 days a week, work, work, work. And it's very difficult for me to imagine investing that kind of energy, even for 6 to 9 months, on a product for something else, something that I just didn't believe in, something that didn't come from something inside of me. You know what I mean? It's almost as though someone would say, hey, Don, you could make a ton of money if you dropped everything and drove a cab for 9 months. The cab business in this town is amazing, and you can make a ton of cash. It's a ton of cash, and I like money as much as the next guy, but it just seems like an alien step for me to take. Like, why would I do that? Why would I want to do that when I don't, at least right now, I don't really need to? The other side of it, too, I don't think I'd be very good at it. I think I, to no small degree, I think I probably made Rejected in order to prevent myself from ever being approached to make a commercial ever again.
This was a warning shot across the bow.
Yeah, which kind of backfired because then they just took that and ripped that off in their own way. But the way I write is so unconscious. You know, I'm sure it's just like any other writer. You're doing the dishes, and all of a sudden you have the ending of the movie. You don't know really where that came from, but it works, and you piece it together. And over the course of 2 years, that's kind of how I sculpt these movies. I'm writing as I go, and I'm kind of shaping it. And I think in the world of animation, that's very unusual, because usually you've got a locked script before you even start drawing. And if you try to imagine that in the commercial world, I mean, if you say the end product has got to be a paper towel commercial, I've got no way of knowing how I could possibly reverse engineer that into something interesting. And I've been approached with other kind of cool-sounding offers, you know, like, hey, do you want to do a half-hour animated Christmas special for our television station? You can do anything you want to. And that might be kind of interesting, but again, it's starting from, like, this endpoint that I'm not used to working with. It's like, okay, it's got to be a Christmas special, and it's just, I've got nothing. I've got no point of reference for that sort of work, so...
You could do the William Burroughs, A Junkie's Christmas. That would be a great one to animate.
I think that's been done, hasn't it?
Has it?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, I can cut in here and say thank God for the internet when it comes to short films, because at least in this country, shorts have been really neglected. You look at European network television, you look at Canal Plus or Channel 4, and they have shorts all the time between their shows, short films. But here, the network television and Hollywood film industry has really cut down on the amount of venues that people can catch short films just on a daily basis. So, you know, now we have the internet, and that's all nice. But one of the reasons that you did start the animation show, the touring festival with Mike Judge, was that you said you wanted to free the work of these independent artists from the dungeons of internet exhibition.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the internet is a great tool, but it's not ideal. It's pretty far from ideal. I mean, like you said, there's just no market for shorts in the United States. Nobody's found a way to make money off of them, and that's pretty much the end of the argument in this country. In Europe and in Canada, you've got these great film boards. You've got actual government support for the arts, which is unheard of in this country. And like you said, you've also got shorts on television. You've got government-run television, so instead of commercials, they run shorts. And there's an actual demand for them, therefore. And there's appearance of shorts in movie theaters still over there. And it's just dead in this country. You know, every now and then MTV comes up with something. Every now and then there's something going on that's not in just your local film festival. But it's few and far between. And the trouble with the internet is you can't make a living off of it. To me, it's the last place a filmmaker would want their work to appear if they are intending to make a living off of doing this. You know, I've kind of over the years learned to just pattern my releases as if I was a big Hollywood studio. So we'll do theatrical, we'll do a DVD release, start licensing for television, and then, you know, maybe we'll let our guard up and let the kids bootleg it for the internet. There's just no business pattern.
That's what I was wondering when I was looking at your stuff on YouTube. I presumed that you didn't post any of that stuff yourself.
No. We if it's a new film that we don't want on there, we'll yank it.
Yeah.
But beyond that, you know, we don't want to harass fans. We don't want to bum everyone out. I mean, it's my responsibility as the filmmaker to provide alternatives, and that's where our DVD releases come from. we figure, okay, well, these are going to be bootlegged anyway. So yeah. Let's come up with the greatest, most amazing DVD we possibly can make. Let's make this thing packed with features. So we made Better Films Volume 1, and there's just hours of extras. Every single sketch, every video clip, deleted scene, pencil sketch, I mean, it's immense. And I think that's what the fans want, and that's ultimately how you don't get bootlegged.
We've been talking a lot during this conversation about art versus commerce. So pretend that you're Orson Welles, you're 25, you've just walked into RKO, you have complete control and a pretty huge budget. What would you do?
Wow. Back in 1925? 35.
Anytime.
Or 2005.
Okay. It's getting a little more general then. Well, I tell you what the first thing I do is, there's a project that I'm finally developing for television, and that's probably the first thing I'd get off the ground. It's the first time I've had an idea that I've wanted to explore in that longer format.
What can you tell us about the TV project?
It's not related to anything else I've done. It's set 100 years ago. It's probably just going to be a miniseries. I'm not a big fan of sitcoms that are open-ended, where every episode ends by resetting the formula. Like, I think the only interesting thing for television for me is to be able to tell a longer project and to actually have a conclusion to it. So it'll be a miniseries. It's a very strange project to try and go out there and sell, but on the other hand, I think that's one of its major selling points.
And where will our listeners be able to catch this new show of yours? Maybe Comedy Central?
Probably not Comedy Central. It was set up for Adult Swim. They decided they might not be able to afford it. We're talking to a few places to find out where the best home would be. But you just stay tuned to the Bitter Films website, and we won't let it go by quietly once it starts.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures here on non-commercial KBOO Radio. We're really pleased to have Don Hertzfeld as a guest. Thank you very much, Don, for joining us.
Hey, no worries.
And I'll mention that Don's films have over 100 awards behind them, including Academy Award nominations. So hoping that things go well for I Am So Proud of You in the coming year.
Yeah, it's real early to tell, but I think, as long as people enjoy it, that's good enough for me.
Well, I'm your host, S.W. Conser.
And I'm still Bill Dodge.
And thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to Don Hertzfeld for being our guest this morning. Everybody tune in to Words and Pictures on KBOO and check out Don's films at bitterfilms.com.